This is Car Expert.
They called the police on us because they said there's an idiot riding down the mountain with a pool noodle attached to his bicycle.
Autonomous vehicles are great, but they're very polite. They don't beep horns, they don't get upset with people.
It's a noise that's not really like an electric car, but it sounds like distant screaming children.
We just haven't seen this kind of competitiveness at the lowest end of the hot hatch market for a very, very long time.
G'day, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week for episode 3, we're joined by Mike Costello.
Hello.
And Scott Colley.
Back again. Hello, Mandy.
Moco, you've been behind the wheel of the MGHS this week. How have you found it?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So MG is obviously a Chinese-owned brand now, SAIC Motor, which is the world's biggest, China's biggest automotive conglomerate. A lot of advertising that MG is doing lately, and it's actually inside the top 20 selling brands now, doing really, really well, outselling a lot of much better known brands. And you can sort of see why on the surface, right? A 7-year warranty, 5-star safety, priced between 30 and 40 grand, depending on spec. Hyundai Tucson sized SUV, as the HS is. Looks okay. Plenty of luxury features, big touchscreen, all the active safety tech that you see on more expensive cars. So value proposition, pretty good. There are still some rough edges there in terms of the way the engine and DSG talk to each other. The ride quality could be a bit better. There's still sort of 10% of that engineering polish, as you'd call it, that needs to be added. But when you compare it to the sort of Chinese cars that I was driving 5 years ago, the jump has been significant. And it's very easy to see why somebody might look at this car, especially considering, you know, one of the big reasons not to buy a Chinese car is brand. And the MG brand is pretty well known. A lot of people probably don't know where it's from these days. And it's got a little bit of heritage that others don't. So you could see why they're getting so popular. And it's not a class leader by any stretch yet, but it's certainly the best car from that part of the world that I've driven.
The thing that jumped out to me about that MG you're driving, Moco, is the bright red Supersport button on the steering wheel. What does it actually do? Because it seems so out of place in a small, sort of sensible family SUV.
Yeah, so this is a 1.5-litre turbocharged SUV. It's no rocket ship. It's the quickest 0 to 100 time I got was 10.2 seconds. So you're not going to hold up traffic, but it's certainly no rocket. There is a 2-litre with, I think, 170 kilowatts that's coming next year, but for the time being, it's no rocket ship. That button, basically, it's like a lot of cars that have sport and eco mode, so it sharpens up the throttle calibration, tells the gearbox mapping to hold lower gears for a bit longer, but it doesn't turn it into some sort of super performance SUV, as the name might suggest. I might even tell you that the fact that that car has paddle shifters and a red sport button would be the most extraneous, stupid thing in the world.
Does it have the 12 o'clock on the steering wheel?
No, it doesn't, thankfully. Look, it's pure marketing, pure branding. MG is not the only brand to do that, so I won't smash them alone. But yeah, if you see a big red button on the wheel that says sport, don't expect to turn it into a Porsche Macan.
Quickly, Scully, you've been driving the Audi S6. Been having fun in that one?
I really, really like it. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit different to the MG in that the sport button actually does quite a bit. But yeah, I've had very limited experience with Audis up until now, but the S6 is just beautiful. Like, it's the sort of car you sit in, and I quite like the touchscreens and everything. I find it quite simple to use. So it's just nice. And it's really clever. It's got some cool stuff in there, like the transmission and the GPS work together. And there's an area near me that I drove after picking the car up where the speed goes from 80 down to 60. And the car actually realized that was coming up in a couple of hundred meters, got a little pulse through the accelerator pedal. So I lifted off and the engine cut out and the car coasted down to 60 from 80 without using any fuel because the engine was turned off. So there's some really, really clever stuff in there, but it all sort of just works in the background. It's really excellent so far.
We know that the authorities insist that speed regulation is all about safety, and a lot of us think that really, you know, putative speed regulation is more about revenue. I'd be very curious to see what road police thought of systems like this, because clearly they're good because they stop you from speeding, but they will probably also reduce the number of traffic fines people are getting. So I'd be very curious to see what the authorities think of features like this. And is it going to be in line with their safety focus or in line with their revenue focus?
We'll have very to get back true. To you on that one.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be hearing more about these cars very soon when the guys write the reviews up, which you'll see at carexpert.com.au. To keep you up to date with all the latest car news from the past week, we'll start off with a 2021 Hyundai i20N. Scully, look out Fiesta ST and Polo GTI.
This thing is really, really exciting, and we love the i30N, and Hyundai has decided that rather than just trying to make, you know, boring, I say boring, you know, well put together, affordable family hatches, it's going to go all out and really commit to a proper performance division. And that started with the i30N, but we know there's a Kona N coming with all-wheel drive and probably the same engine as the i30N. We know there's an i30N sedan coming, and now there is an i20N, which is the Ford Fiesta Volkswagen Polo-sized hatch they sell in Europe. Reports from overseas, from the Korean car blog, which is really up to date on this stuff and we've done some work with, so keep an eye out for more of more Korean scoops from those guys on Car Expert, have said that the i20N won't necessarily get the same engine as the i30N. It's more likely to get a 1.6-litre turbo engine, the same as the one that's in the high-powered Kona and the i30N line. And it's likely to be hooked up with a DCT option, which is really interesting because the Ford Fiesta ST doesn't have a dual clutch. It's only manual. And the Volkswagen Polo is only dual clutch. There's no manual. So Hyundai offering both would make it quite unique.
I was going to say, isn't it exciting to see this small hot hatch market explode? So obviously Toyota's bringing the Yaris GR to the market soon, before the end of this year. That's going to be, I believe, it's the world's most powerful three-cylinder engine.
So I think you're right there, yeah.
WRC rally-inspired mega little hatch. So you're going to have four of the biggest brands in the market all lobbing these four-ish meter long tiny pocket rockets. We just haven't seen this kind of competitiveness at the lowest end of the hot hatch market for a very, very long time. It's really bloody exciting. And as you said, Scully, given how good the i30N is, and given how much we're looking forward to Hyundai's DCT option, it should be an absolute cracker. And it will be developed at the Nürburgring as well. Obviously, the head of Hyundai N's engineering program used to run BMW M Division's engineering. So they've got the pedigree and the chops to make this something special.
Have we had the i20 in Australia before? I actually can't remember.
Yeah, so they had an Indian-made version in base form a couple of years ago. It was the top seller for a while, but then it was replaced by a European-made model, which they wouldn't have been able to sell here for less than 20 grand and turn a profit on. People sometimes underestimate how unprofitable those cars are. So they haven't offered it for a while. They don't even have the accent anymore, Hyundai. So it doesn't actually have any tiny hatchback below the i30. So this will be the only small hatchback it offers. And obviously this hot one is not going to be any kind of, you know, sub 20 grand bargain.
Love to see a spoiler on the back of that tiny little thing. It'd look great. Now, both of you attended an FCAI briefing today. Virtually, obviously. What was discussed there?
So the big news out of that, which we probably should start by saying, the FCAI is like the peak body for car makers. It's a collection of all the car makers, and it's the body they go through when they're dealing with government working on standards for fuel and emissions and that sort of thing. And Australia has been quite behind the curve when it comes to emission standards. We don't have a really strict target for vehicle fleets like they do in Europe, among other things. So rather than going to government or waiting for government to finally do it, the FCAI and around 40 of its members have come together and voluntarily laid out a plan to cut emissions from new cars by 2030. And the goal of that is to mean that car makers know what emissions levels they need to hit in the future and make it easier for them to make the case to head office when they're trying to get hybrid, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles to Australia.
Yeah, so that's the really big one. At the moment, to give you some context, in Europe and the United States, there are putative measures that punish car brands financially for not meeting certain CO2 targets. So when car manufacturers are producing their most efficient vehicles, they don't bother sending them to Australia because why the hell would they? There's no requirement for them to offer really any standards other than Euro 5, which is kind of a given at this point. So what this will theoretically do is, through the court of public opinion, by publishing a publicly viewable database of exactly what the CO2 emissions of each model are with clarity, They'll hopefully be able to shame OEMs into convincing their parent companies to give us the best green vehicles. And the FCAI is correctly betting on the fact that the public mood towards this has swung, that people are considering this more and more now. And so hopefully they're going to move the dial that way. It also gives them somewhere to negotiate from. I mean, clearly the preference would be for the government to say, this is the target, and if you don't meet it, we're going to fine you. But the FCAI can't really lobby for that if it doesn't have its own kind of set of regulations on the table. So it's a really good start, I would think.
I think it's also worth saying this is really interesting in that, like, nowhere else in the world does the industry set its own emissions targets. In Europe, it's driven quite aggressively by the European Union. In the USA, the federal government has its own rules, but some individual states have theirs as well. So this really is quite unique around the world. But also, because of how late we've started with this, and because of some other factors like the quality of the fuel in Australia and the engines that means some car makers can bring, the rules that we're pushing for by 2030 aren't actually as strict as the emission standards that are coming into Europe on January 1 next year. So this is a really positive step in that it gives certainty and it shows a bit of leadership from the industry. Apparently, this has been a four-year job getting these together. But it's also worth pointing out that even with these standards in place and, you know, not enforceable in the way that they are elsewhere, like Moko said, we're still not necessarily up with the curve with Europe, for example, or, you know, some parts of the USA. I just think that needs mentioning as well, because it's definitely a step, but Australia's, you know, vehicles and our emissions levels aren't just going to drop overnight.
Yeah, just to put some numbers to that, they've split the market up into two. You've got your commercial vehicles, which are your utes and your vans and your big hardcore 4x4s in one bucket, and you've got your passenger vehicles and soft rotor SUVs in another bucket. And by the end of 2030, they want the soft rotors and passenger cars' average emissions to be under 100 grams of CO2 per kilometre and 145 grams of CO2 per kilometre for the commercial vehicles. Now, right now in Europe, as Scully said, the target for January 1, 2021 is under 100 grams for the passenger side of things. So clearly, we're at least a decade behind. But before this, you couldn't even say we were a decade behind because we didn't really have a position at all. So we were, you know, theoretically endlessly behind the rest of the world. So this catches us up. It's good to see. Clearly, it's a bit of a toothless tiger and it will require the public to support it by not putting their money into those brands that aren't meeting their self-imposed targets. Otherwise, this won't really do a whole lot.
Yeah. All right. And lastly, Scully, some news about the Mitsubishi Outlander and Eclipse Cross.
Yes, Mitsubishi is a really interesting brand in that its products aren't necessarily as new or as sort of exciting in some ways as some of their rivals, but they sell really strongly because they've got this reputation for being, you know, long lasting, and they're priced really sharply. And that's before you walk into a dealership and start negotiating. So the Outlander and the Eclipse Cross are two of its SUVs. The ASX is the bestseller, and that's recently been given a minor refresh. But the Outlander, which is sort of a rival for the Mazda CX-5 and the Toyota RAV4, is going to get an all-new model next year, which is really big news in the world of Mitsubishi. Based on the Engelberg Tourer we saw in Geneva last year, which was a concept car, it's going to look really sharp as well, with a really aggressive front end like the Pajero Sport. And some sort of more European sort of upmarkety design cues at the back. We're also expecting to see a more sophisticated plug-in hybrid powertrain. And Moko, I know you're a big fan of the current Outlander FEV, but the new one's expected to have a bigger battery, more powerful motors, and a longer electric range, which will make it really quite unique in the affordable SUV market if it does sort of come in around the same price tag as the current car, because it's promising to offer the same sort of range that Mercedes and BMW are getting from their plug-in hybrids, but in a practical, affordable 7-seat SUV body.
Yeah, I mean, the Outlander FEV has always been an interesting car from Mitsubishi because unless you're an Evo 6 Machina era rally fan like me, Mitsubishi hasn't done a whole lot of aggressive, interesting engineering since. with the exception of the FEV Outlander, you know, world's top-selling FEV for a long time. So it's really good that the company's continuing on that. The other interesting thing about this Outlander is it'll be the first Mitsubishi that's developed entirely as part of the Renault-Nissan-Mitsubishi three-way alliance. So obviously Nissan is the major shareholder in Mitsubishi these days. And so Mitsubishi gets access to all that stuff that it's, sister and brother brands are doing. So you can expect this Outlander to share a lot with the new X-Trail, which was revealed by Nissan, I think it was last month. So you can certainly see that Mitsubishi is hopefully going to be able to start to, you know, launch new models with a bit more frequency than it was previously.
The Eclipse Cross has been, I think, a couple of years now, Scully, and it's due for a facelift this year.
It is. So the Eclipse Cross is a larger car slightly than the ASX, and it's meant to be a little bit more upmarket. Doesn't quite have the same sales impact, but it still does decent numbers, and it's going to get an exterior sort of tweak, some interior updates, and, yeah, just general midlife facelift stuff. It'll be interesting to see what the new infotainment system is like, because Mitsubishi and Nissan, when now I say it, can be a little bit hit and miss on that front.
The current one's terrible. The current one's got a Lexus-style like trackpad like you have on a laptop. Touchscreen too, but, yeah, rather than like a rotary dial, you've got this weird touch-sensitive haptic pad, which is kind of crap, if I'm honest with you. It doesn't work very well, at least to my sensibilities.
No, I'm with you on that one. So I'm just curious as to what the alternative is, because the one in the current Outlander was recently updated, but, you know, is functional at absolute best. I can't think of a really good Mitsubishi infotainment system to drop in there. So yeah, Hopefully this is the start of something new that maybe borrows a bit from Nissan, which has made some strides in that area, because that will obviously go a long way to making the Eclipse Cross a little bit more appealing.
It's a really weird car, that. It's got a 1.5-litre turbo engine, so a fairly sophisticated engine, but it's based on the ASX, which is a really old platform. And in terms of its design, from the front three-quarter angle, it looks quite sharp. But then if you look at it from the wrong angle, particularly from the rear three-quarters, it has the most strange, slightly off proportions. It's not that it's hideous. It's just that there's something about 10% off about the way that it's set up proportionally.
And so just a whiff
from the wrong angle. Yeah, it looks really weird. So I hope she can tweak that as well.
Yeah, a little bit less Pontiac Aztec, please.
Yes. You can head to the site to keep up to date with all the latest car news. For anyone who hasn't caught up on this piece titled How I Became a Cyclist and Why I Hate Myself, you would assume that it was written by bicycle-loving Scott Colley, but alas, he doesn't hate himself for it, so it was not him. In fact, it was car expert founder Alborz Fella. Alborz, firstly, are you okay?
I'm fine. I'm having a great time being a cyclist. And actually, you know what? Since the gyms have opened, I've been riding a bit less because I don't want to die on the road. But yeah, mainly because the gyms have reopened. But yeah, it's been good. Less hate for myself.
Good. What have you learned from the experience?
That my left knee doesn't like cycling. I did about 50 days straight when we had that lockdowns where you couldn't go to the gym, but I literally rode 50 days straight. And I think about the 45th day, my left knee was like, okay, it's enough. Like, just stop doing this. Thankfully, the gym's reopened, so I started going back to the gym. But I learned that cars just don't give a shit about cyclists. And I had two proper near misses on the road. And then I started riding on the bicycle path predominantly because I didn't want to die, and that was a bit boring. So, yeah, not for me, thank you, but good experience.
So your latest piece, Australia's Most Dangerous Road Rule, is now up at carexpert.com.au. What's it all about?
Yeah, look, so as I was, doing my 50 days of cycling experience, I realized there's a couple of rules for drivers to follow, and one of them is the distance rule. So in every state except in Victoria, where you lovely people live, or are locked down, I should say, there is a minimum distance of 1 meter for motorists to pass cyclists when the speed limit is below 60. And then that increases to 1.5 meters when the speed limit is above 60. And, you know, when you think about that, you kind of go, it's actually really, that's not much, is it? It's only a meter or a meter and a half. But you know, we actually went and got a pool noodle and cut it to size and attached it to the end of my bike. And if you can actually visualize 1.5 meters sticking out the side of your bike, it is really, really freaking long. And most of the roads that the cyclists, at least here in Brisbane, ride around in are super narrow, super tight, and almost impossible to overtake whilst giving that amount of distance. So we put it to the test. We actually, a couple of friends of mine, plus William here, we went up and attached the pool noodle to the bike and rode down Mount Nebo, Mount Glorious, and got some amazing footage and video of just how insanely difficult it is to pass a cyclist given the actual legal distance required.
What was the reaction from some of the passers-by that you saw?
Well, actually, it was getting to a point where I had my wife with me at one point also riding her bicycle, although hers was electric, so it was a lot easier to go up the mountain. But side by side, you know, which you're allowed to do, and that's the issue, you know, when you've got two cyclists riding abreast in a really narrow road and you have to give 1.5 meters from the rightmost cyclist, it's just not possible. You actually, not only do you have to go completely on the other side of the road, in some cases you would actually, your right wheel would go on the other, off road on the other side of the road. So it's a crazy amount of distance. And I just don't feel like that's safe. And I didn't, you know, we didn't do this to hate on cyclists, although I'm sure a lot of the comments on the site, some of the cyclists have definitely got a hold of it and having a bit of a field day. That certainly was a reaction I was kind of expecting because cyclists could be quite militant. But the point was that being able to ride two abreast on narrow roads just doesn't make any sense to me. It's nonsensical. It's putting everybody in danger, including the cyclists. And motorists do get fed up. You know, like all the comments from the cyclists are just have patience, blah, 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 blah. And I totally get that, right? But when you're following two cyclists abreast for 5-10 minutes, you're going to try and overtake them at some point. And, you know, it's just insane. And I kind of feel like just having to ride single file down narrow roads makes a lot of sense to me. And they can still ride their bicycles. We still give them the full amount of respect and make sure everybody's safe. But why put everybody in danger by having that two abreast rule? That's sort of where I was getting at.
I do think, yeah, common sense is probably the thing that needs to drive this, because as someone who, yeah, I often ride on quite wide beach roads in Victoria where there's two lanes and there's space for cyclists to go two abreast, but I know the majority of cyclists that I ride with and see riding, when it does get narrow, unless there's no traffic, will single file to make themselves less big as well, because obviously you don't want to be putting yourself in a position where cars are trying to squeeze past you. So I think, yeah, common sense from both sides required, obviously, but I also don't really have much of an issue with this idea that the government says, look, try to give people a meter, or, you know, give them a meter and a half.
But it's not try. In Victoria, it's try. In Victoria, it's a recommendation, and I think that's fair. In every other place in Australia, it's a fine. It's a 3 or 4 demerit and quite an expensive fine if you don't.
So how is it being enforced in Queensland, for example, then? Because I suppose there's not police running around with a pool noodle asking cyclists and drivers to stop still exactly where they are and measuring.
This is the thing. Majority of cyclists, especially the ones that ride down the road that we tested this, and you know, whilst we were testing this, we actually had cyclists running 3 abreast down, which was just insanity. Wow. And you know, they flew past us, but they all have GoPros and they report the cars. You know, anyone that goes past that does, they don't like the distance which they're giving, which has to be 1.5 meters. They report the cars, and you know, the police have to take it seriously because it's a road rule. So, you know, I feel like it's a little bit unfair. I don't want to put myself at risk in a car to give 1.5 meters around a corner of two bicycles riding abreast down a really narrow road. And at the same time, I don't want to put the cyclist at risk. So, you know, it puts you in a tricky situation. I totally agree with you. I mean, single file down a narrow road, that should just be
common sense.
But it's not, because they're allowed to do it. And, you know, as some of the commenters point out, just because you're allowed to do it doesn't mean it's safe. But I think for a lot of the cyclists, especially the ones that are slightly more militant than you, Scully, they just feel like it's their right. So it's almost like I feel like they're trying to prove a point by doing it because that's their right. And I think all that does is agitate the people behind them who then take bigger risks to go past them, which then creates all these problems and puts everybody at risk. So anyway, that was a fun experiment. The actual best part of it was that we got reported to police by cyclists because they said,
"What?"
Yeah, they called the police on us because they said there's an idiot riding down the mountain with a pool noodle attached to his bicycle. And look, that's a pretty accurate description. You know, I was an idiot riding down the mountain with a pool noodle attached to my bicycle, but I was trying to prove how ridiculous that distance was. But I think because they couldn't probably even get past me, they decided to call the cops. But the cops came and we had a fun chat and they thought it was really entertaining. In fact, they actually told me that legally in Queensland, in order for me to attach the pool noodle to my bike, I have to attach a 1.5 meter flag to the noodle to tell people I have a pool noodle attached to my bike. So It would have to have been 3 meters long, which meant that I would have just got hit by every car going in every direction, which was quite entertaining. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic. podcast@carexpert.com.au, or you can leave your comments below in the article. Alborz, it was a great read, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Our resident car tech expert, Jeff Quattromani, joins us now to keep us in the tech world loop. Welcome to Car Expert, the podcast, Jeff.
Hello, team. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get started, for anyone who doesn't know you, can you give us a quick rundown on why and how you got into cars and technology?
Oh, look, I think for me, cars has always been a natural thing growing up with, you know, watching the V8s around Bathurst or anything else. But for technology, it's just been a weird passion of mine that, you know, growing up building my own computer because we couldn't really afford to buy the latest and greatest, and then scavenging parts. My career has been in IT, started in IT support and move my way up into different rankings. But whenever you're in IT, you're going to have colleagues, relatives asking you, what phone should I buy? What computer should I buy? And eventually I thought, I might just write about it. I might just start writing about this stuff and stop answering just one person at a time. And eventually these two things just blended together. And, you know, cars are big gadgets now. So it makes sense to talk about the tech inside the vehicles we're driving.
Absolutely. So we might get down to business. The first thing, Apple Car Key, what is it and how can we get it?
Look, this is so exciting. So we all know that Apple is really trying to get rid of anything that's in our pockets, whether it's the keys to our front door, the credit card that sits in our wallet. They're now making their way into the car key itself. So that, you know, the fob or the actual key that we normally carry around, this won't be something that you'll see on older vehicles or even current vehicles. The first car you'll see this on is the BMW 5 Series or the new model that's coming this month or next month, I believe. And you'll see it appear in the latest operating system of iPhones. So we call it iOS 14. And essentially, it's going to mean that you can walk up to the vehicle, tap your phone onto the door handle and jump in, start the car. You can leave the actual key at home.
Jeff, what happens when your phone battery goes flat? Because my phone battery is always flat and I don't love the idea of being locked out of my car because of it.
Look, it's a scary thought and it's always the first question. Apple obviously always thinks of these things, I'm sure, and they're going to give you 5 hours of reserve battery just for the key to work. So even if your phone is effectively dead, you'll still have a five-hour window to run back to your car and unlock it before you'll be in trouble. Fortunately, once you get in the car, you can always charge your phone as well. But yeah, actually getting into it could be the problem.
What's the likelihood of this going out to other manufacturers, Jeff? Is there any word on that yet?
Look, it's always going to happen. I think when you think about what Apple did with CarPlay and how, you know, it took time for some manufacturers to jump on board or to accept, you know, effectively a replacement of their infotainment system when you look at it, I think all brands are going to want it because customers are going to demand it. Whether it's Ferrari or even your smaller brands, you have to have features like this eventually. And I think it's been interesting to see some car makers develop their own apps where you can unlock cars and start vehicles. And they're going to have to consider whether they should stick with it or adapt the Apple Car Key.
What's the situation with security? Because obviously having your phone linked up to your credit card, for example, if someone does get into that, maybe it's $100 at a time per transaction, you can shut that down quite easily. But if something goes wrong with a phone-based car key, I mean, it's a BMW 5 Series, it's $100,000 worth of car that could be stolen or have something go wrong. So how is it actually secured?
Yeah, this is a really good point. So first of all, if the phone itself can be set up to be in express mode, which means that anyone who just picks up the phone can tap it on the door handle and get into the car. You can choose to have Face ID mandatory to use car key, which would mean that you have to unlock the phone effectively to get into the car. I think there will be concerns around hacking as well and what will happen in between or in the cloud that potentially somebody could get access to your car key. I think it would be hard. I think when you think about the security that Apple puts in place, it would be a very difficult thing to do. And obviously, if you lost your phone, the good thing is, you know, using the Apple iCloud, you can pull services or even wipe devices remotely as well. So I would be confident to do it. And to your point with credit cards, I think we're getting comfortable with that. Obviously, the risk is a little bit lower, but at the end of the day, it seems to make sense to me, I think.
And Jeff, for our friends who use Android devices, is there an Android equivalent of this?
Not yet. And honestly, it's always sad to sort of see this happen where you've got effectively a service that's dependent on the phone that you own. And you know, we've seen even in previous BMW models, for example, when they don't support Android Auto, you think, hang on a minute, does that mean I have to have an Apple phone to really make the most of the infotainment system in the car? I think in this case, it could be just another reason that you probably should own an iPhone if you're buying a new BMW 5 Series, as sad as that sounds.
It is interesting because BMW has been quite early to this technology, but previously to use a BMW digital car key, you actually had to have an Android phone with the right type of NFC. So it's a real flip from BMW, from only supporting sort of phone entry with Android to now driving it through car key.
Look, it is funny. Now, when this was announced at the Worldwide Developers Conference, basically a big Apple event, the lady who did it used to be a BMW employee. So I'm not saying that BMW's first Apple car key because of her, but it probably is. So I'm guessing we're going to see a lot of firsts for Apple appear on BMW.
While we're on Apple, Jeff, iOS 14's coming, and that also means changes to CarPlay. What can we expect with this?
Look, I love CarPlay. I think for me, it doesn't matter what car I'm getting into, once I attach my iPhone, I know I'm going to have a pretty good infotainment experience. They're going to make some changes. First of all, the biggest thing people will notice is wallpapers. So you can actually choose some different colors to have in the background. It's not just going to be black or white anymore. I like that, and I've actually been using it in the beta, and it's quite nice. But the biggest changes we're going to see is parking apps, EV charging, as well as food. And what that means effectively is you could be driving, say you're driving towards the city, you can look at how many parking spots are available in your Wilson's parking app, for example, through CarPlay. Or if you're driving towards Macca's, place your order before you actually get there as well. So you start to think about how we can start to integrate more services into the car, and obviously doing it safely. That's going to be fascinating to watch.
Awesome how fast this tech's moving. Now, the next thing we wanted to touch on is to get your thoughts on the autonomous car. Have you actually been in one, and would you entertain the idea?
Yeah, look, so every year, all these tech heads go to Las Vegas for what's called the Consumer Electronics Show, and it's becoming a bit of a car show, to be honest. There's so many autonomous vehicle manufacturers or guys who just do LiDAR technology or demonstrating things. And whenever we go there, the best thing to do is to get into an Uber and look out for the cars that are being demonstrated on real roads in Vegas as autonomous vehicles, where there is somebody there, but effectively it's just doing joyrides. And you tell the Uber that if you need to get through traffic, just to cut that car off, because it always lets you in. And that's one of the funniest things here, is that autonomous vehicles are great, but they're very polite. They don't beep horns. They don't get upset with people. So yes, I have been inside some of them, and they work really well in a very controlled environment.
Our roads are vastly different from the rest of the world. So what do you think is needed in Australia for a fully autonomous vehicle to work here?
Look, I think we've got a long way to go. And as much as you know, Tesla lovers will you know, be very upset with me saying that, I think that if you actually want to really let go of the steering wheel, turn your seats around to have conversations with people in the back, it's going to be a dream. It's going to be a bit of a dream. Maybe our kids will see it. Maybe they won't. Obviously, our roads, for starters, needs a lot of change. There's not a lot of line markings. If you think about situational awareness, we've got a lot of problems there where, you know, a car might be able to get you from A to B if the conditions remain the same every single time. Not thinking about other people on the road, given that autonomous cars need to work in an environment where there's also, you know, normal drivers. But if you think about roadworks as a simple thing, if I'm driving towards roadworks, I've usually got a person with a lollipop who can tell me when to get around or when to go into an oncoming lane to safely move around their work. An autonomous vehicle today, it will just stop and it will sit there and it will wait for those roadworks to finish before it goes through. So, you know, there's a number of things that need to happen, and smart cities will be the biggest factor, I think, in communicating with those autonomous cars.
So, Jeff, one of the things that we've heard quite a bit of out of the Australian autonomous vehicle industry is that this is going to start with sort of mobility pods and that sort of thing. Where do you see, maybe not so much in terms of autonomous cars that can take us from A to B on the roads, but where do you see the development of autonomous shuttles and buses and vehicles that can maybe take us from the parking lot at an airport to the terminal we need to go to, when that's a thing we can do again?
I think that's the first thing that we'll see. You know, I mean, already in parts of Newcastle, for example, in New South Wales, you've got those shuttle services that effectively can drive you up and down through a city, almost like a tram that's not on tracks. So it does happen already. We've seen some actual retirement villages adapt autonomous vehicles where it helps them get from the clubhouse back to their small room, whatever it may be. So I think when you've got a very well-defined and a perfect environment to get from point to point, absolutely autonomous can work. It might be slow because it's got a lot of thinking to do and how it gets there, almost like my robot vacuum in the house. If I tell it to go and vacuum the kitchen, it gets there. It just sometimes takes the long way around, or it gets upset if there's something in the way. Those perfect environments always do work point to point for sure.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jeff.
The first hydrogen car to touch down in Australia, the Toyota Mirai, sadly isn't on sale yet, but it's currently doing trials between councils and the government. But while they've been parked up due to COVID-19, Paul Marrick managed to snatch one for a test drive. Paul, hello.
Hello, team. How are we?
Very good. Now, first, can we get the elephant in the room out of the way first?
Okay, off you
what
go.
What about the design?
Oh, sorry. Yes. the design. I've described it as a melted Prius. Because I personally think it's a little bit ugly, but as you all know, I'm not the last word on style. And in my mind, I look at it this way: the car was released in 2015. Generally, there's like a 5-year gestation period for designing cars. So technically, this is a design that was modern in 2010 or something like that. So if you cast your mind back 10 years ago, this probably looked pretty cool back then.
They've actually launched a new generation Mirai overseas, and it looks really quite nice.
That's stunning.
So it does show that you don't need to make eco cars look stupid.
Yeah, but then I guess sort of veering slightly off topic, that was kind of the appeal of the Prius, I think, in the States, because if you wanted people to know that you were a greenie, you drove a Prius and everyone could see that, oh, it's a different car, they're eco-friendly. I think that's what they tried to continue with the Mirai, but that's fallen out of trend recently with brands like Tesla that have, aside from the Cybertruck, fairly normal-looking cars that are still green. So you don't have to have a weird-looking car to be green.
It is it's a running joke in LA that anyone who wants to be an actor or involved in Hollywood has to drive a Prius. It's just part of the uniform there now.
Not anymore.
God.
Paul, so you're a former engineer, so I'm just wondering whether you can explain this in simple terms for us.
Yes.
How does the hydrogen setup work in it?
Okay, so I'll run you through the pricing. So if it was to go on sale in Australia, it would be the equivalent of something like $115,000 Australian dollars. It's incredibly expensive. It is cheaper in the US because of all the subsidies they have, and it comes with free hydrogen filling there as well. And obviously, it's not on sale in Australia, but if it was, it would be expensive. And it's estimated that Toyota loses around $80,000 per car they sell based on the R&D and the cost of all the materials inside the car. Now, how does hydrogen work? So the very basics of it is hydrogen is effectively split. There is a process called electrolysis, which is where they split hydrogen from oxygen, and the input there is water. So you put in water, it splits the hydrogen and the oxygen, and then the hydrogen is transported for storage and then pumped into these cars. When it reaches the car, a chemical reaction occurs in a fuel stack where the hydrogen interacts with oxygen and then creates electricity, but the output is water. So you kind of complete the cycle. And someone said to me the other day, and it's quite fascinating when you think about it like this, this is the freshest water in the world, because water that falls out of the sky is just rain, and it's sort of recycled through evaporation and all that sort of stuff. So this is extremely fresh water, which is why the car wheezes every now and then. I find that quite funny, because it sort of emits 6 liters of water per 100 kilometers of travel, which is sort of interesting. So no gases or anything like that. Now, the question is, and part of the debate here with hydrogen vehicles, if you look at the electrolysis process, and I'm sort of getting into the weeds here, but the electrolysis process requires a lot of energy. So you have to use a lot of electricity to split that hydrogen from the water. And the problem with that is, in comparison to a battery electric vehicle, is the energy that you use to create the electricity that you split the hydrogen with, you then have to reuse again when you transport it and then feed it into the car. Whereas with a battery electric vehicle, if you plug it into a power point, you've only created that energy once. So look, I think it'll be interesting to see how these cars go. How does it drive? It just drives like a normal car. It doesn't feel sort of any different to any other car on the road, which is, I think, what is most appealing about the hydrogen tech, because it only takes about 5 minutes to fill a car.
So what is the hydrogen infrastructure like in Australia at the moment? Because obviously it's limited even compared to electric vehicles, but there must be some, right?
It's a bit like your humour, Scott, non-existent. Basically, there's one refilling station at the moment that Toyota has available, and it's a portable station. Outside of that, there really isn't much. But the grand vision here is trucking, buses, all of these back-to-base places where you could have some electrolysis infrastructure somewhere that charges these devices, and then they go back out on the road again. You don't have to have it sitting there for hours charging. Actually, Costello, I think didn't you do a story on like a portable solution that an Aussie company was working on?
Yeah, that's right. So just before we get into that, I will also point out that Hyundai is also very big into hydrogen. They have a hydrogen car called Nexo, which is an SUV, and they've sold 20 now to the ACT government as government fleet vehicles, and they've actually built an electrolysis-based refueler that uses wind power and is set up at a giant wind farm just outside of Canberra there. And there's a big push. The federal government through its ARENA fund actually funded a lot of that. So there is another brand and some more infrastructure if you're in the ACT and if you work for the government, but it's obviously still super limited. Yeah, as you said, Paulie, there's a mob in Australia called H2X that are making hydrogen vehicles. Australia really wants to get into hydrogen because Korea, Japan, China are big into hydrogen, and we can export that hydrogen to them. It's a big part of our economy moving forward. Theoretically, you could use a shipping container and put it at a service station or a depot of some sort, and you could actually have electrolysis happening, and you could make a couple of hundred kilograms of pressurized hydrogen a day on site, so you wouldn't need to transport the hydrogen. And if it was at a base or a hub like you just said, Paulie, it would make sense. I mean, I think, as you say, hydrogen is really good in some ways. So for big trucks and heavy vehicles, it can be refilled in about 5 minutes, zero emissions. And you don't have to have, tons and tons of batteries to store that energy on board, because the car is a power plant itself. So if you have a battery powered truck, you've got to have 10 tons of batteries if it's an electric truck. But if it's a fuel cell truck, you don't need to have those batteries. So the GVM is obviously better. So it's interesting that we're looking at hydrogen cars, but I think moving forward, hydrogen trucks, planes and buses and things of that nature makes a hell of a lot more sense.
Yeah, it's ultra fascinating. And the thing that kept reoccurring for me was the safety object. And a lot of people raised that, and I did some digging into it, and it was quite fascinating. When we returned the car, one of the Toyota guys there that specializes in hydrogen tech, he showed us a cutaway from the tank. And there's two hydrogen tanks inside the Prius, and they're pressurized to 10,000 PSI. And just as a comparison, if you have a can of Coke in the fridge, that's pressurized to about 30 PSI. So you can imagine having 300 or 400 times the amount of pressure inside a car with an extremely flammable gas. But the tanks themselves are made out of enough carbon fiber to build a supercar. They're thick enough to withstand a 50 caliber bullet several times before it pierces the tank. And then a lot of people say, oh, okay, what if it ruptures the tank? Will it explode? Well, the worst that's going to happen is if you have enough force to rupture the tank, you're going to be in a car accident severe enough to have killed you to start with anyway. But if you compare it to an internal combustion car, if you rupture a fuel tank and then have a spark near it, you're creating a localized fire that's constantly fueled. Hydrogen gas escapes very quickly because it's extremely light. So a lot of people think back to the Hindenburg, and the Hindenburg didn't actually have such a big flame because of the hydrogen. It was actually the diesel on board and then the flammable substance that the canvas shell was made out of that caused the fire. So I think those myths are slowly sort of going away, and it's good to see that car makers have put so much energy into making these safe devices.
I do think the upshot of all of this, and this argument often comes up with electric vehicles as well, because they have been prone occasionally to catching fire while they're parked when they're charging, is that realistically any car is made of a whole lot of really combustible or flammable materials, and they're all working together until they're not. So
yeah,
it's not like internal combustion cars don't catch fire or battery powered cars don't catch fire or don't have problems. And I think we need to consider that when we think about new technology.
The other really crazy things is this silly rivalry between hydrogen acolytes and electric car acolytes. I mean, you see it all the time, you know, the Nikola guys fighting with Elon Musk. It's almost like, guys, you've got a common enemy, which is internal combustion engine. And if you've got hydrogen fuel cell that works and you've got battery electric that works, why fight? But that seems to be the lay of the land at the moment.
Paul, I'm interested to know what the Mirai sounds like when you're accelerating.
Okay, so this is going to sound strange, but it sounds like distant screaming children. It's a really weird sound. So
how do you know what that sounds like?
Yes, that's for the other podcast. It's a noise that's not really like an electric car. So an electric car has like a humming, whirring noise, whereas this has quite a high-pitched noise. It's not obtrusive, but it is quite noticeable, and that is the noise of the fuel stack working. The difference with the Mirai, though, is that it has a small, I think it's like a 1.6 kilowatt hour battery on board. And what it does is when you're rolling out of the throttle, it will charge that battery. And the battery is used as a boost mechanism when you go hard on the throttle, so that it sort of bridges that gap, because the hydrogen system isn't quite sort of razor sharp in terms of its reaction. So that sort of fills the gap for you. But outside of that, it drives just like any other car. And the next generation of this car, instead of being front-wheel drive, will be rear-wheel drive. So I'm wondering whether they're going to build in a little bit of sportiness to it and whether it will become... it definitely won't be as quick as an electric car, 0 to 100, but I wonder whether they will try and dial a bit of sporting nature into it.
Awesome. Well, you can view the very detailed video and the review now at carexpert.com.au. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
That brings it into episode 3 of Car Expert, the podcast for this week. Scott, what cars are we driving next week?
There's a real mix across the team and the three states we're in. It starts with a Kia Sportage SX Plus automatic and runs all the way to an Audi RS6 with a Mazda 3 Sky Active launch in between. So there's a real spread coming up. The highlight for me, though, is Tony Crawford, lover of supercars and all things exciting, reviewing a Suzuki Ignis Series 2.
And you know what? We all know what Crawford's persona is like, and it will be the best car that he's ever driven.
Yes.
And he will rabbit on about how good it is for weeks. and we say that with so much love. I'm really interested in the Mazda 3. It's kind of written as a hybrid in the calendar, but in reality it's that Skyactiv X engine that they've been working on, which is the spark-guided compression ignition. So it kind of combines the attributes of a petrol and a diesel, theoretically. But its numbers on paper aren't that impressive, and its price is pretty high. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this car, but I'm wondering if there's a whole lot of walk, if I'm honest with you. And so Maric is driving that next week. Very, very curious to see what he comes away saying.
I'm completely with you there, because Mazda is really interesting in its approach to hybrid and electric cars. It's decided it's got the one electric vehicle, but it wants to just refine the internal combustion engine as far as it possibly can. It's been doing that with really lean burn tech in Skyactiv. I wonder if we're reaching a point where it can't get enough out of the engines anymore without spending huge bucks for marginal gains. We're sort of hit a point of diminishing returns. So this is going to be a really interesting test of that strategy.
Yeah, I mean, the second Bosch or Continental 48-volt, you know, belt-driven starter alternator costs less than this complex ignition system is the point where it breaks down, right? So it's going to be cheaper than a battery system for sure, but there are a lot of other techniques that you can use now. And Mazda's always been a bit of an innovator, but you know, just like rotary kind of eventually hit the end of the road, there's a lot of a big part of me that's sort of skeptical about how this is actually going to go, but we'll find out soon, no doubt.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on how we're going with the Car Expert podcast. You can email us podcast@carexpert.com.au if there's something that you love us talking about, if there's something that you don't, or there's something that you would like us to talk about, please let us know. I'd love to hear from you. Mike Costello and Scott Colley, it has been a pleasure as always.
Really nice to hear your voice, Mandy. It's a shame we can't do this in person yet, but
yeah,
when all this madness dies down, hopefully we will.
Yeah, mask up, Mandy. We'll see you soon.